You're helping him.
Having assembled four members, they'll be starting. We have a lot long agenda today, and I want to get through all the content. The agenda is accurate to a point. Just so you know, we have two testifiers who have to go early. Mr. Leitz and Ms. Dorfman can come up to the table. And then we're going to take a... We want to actually allow the most time we can for the topic of emergency medical assistance, and so we thought that by doing the other three contents that would be far shorter than the other one. We could have all the time available for the testifiers and whatever comments we have about that. So that's our thinking on that. This was meant to be the first of two hearings on the topics of things that have come up, either reports or big issues, et cetera. Tomorrow was canceled due to floor session, and that's being rescheduled for some other time. We're going to work on that. And so the issues that were coming up for tomorrow are just as important to us as, you know, the things we're talking about today. We thought, oh, two at once, two in a day, two in a row. So don't think we've ignored those. Just to help the audience of advocates and lobbyists and people interested in these things, there's a number of things that have arisen out of the work of last session. Some have been surprising, some we knew. Some were public a long, long time before we got the bill done, and they shouldn't have been surprising to people because they're around since March. And the impact has been something we didn't expect, or it's what we thought might happen. I'm open to talk about anything with anybody about that. But my view on the budget is I pray it's flat again. I expect my target to be zero. Which is good news and bad news. If you want something fixed, that's bad news. So the problems we do have to solve some problems in our area here, and that means it's in our paltry $23 billion budget to find the money to solve our problems. That's my intention. And so, with that in mind, I just wanted to accept that as a preamble. This is our first kind of real hearing. We've had the bonding, and then last time we did some other stuff, the budget, but. So Mr. Leitz is going to testify about emergency medical assistance, and then Ms. Dorfman, and if we can hold member comments on that topic until the end, unless it's to the witness and brief, then that's okay. So Mr. Leitz, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Scott Leitz. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, I was here today to give the committee some background information on the Emergency Medical Assistance Program. Yeah. In particular, I'll start by talking a little bit about what EMA is. I'll use that shorthand for the program. What changes occurred to the program during the 2011 session, and then the department's implementation activities since the passage of the changes during the 2011 session.
Yeah.
Under federal law, states are required to provide care that is necessary for the treatment of an emergency, a medical condition, for persons who do not otherwise qualify for federally funded Medicaid. They'd be individuals who would otherwise meet the criteria for being eligible for Medicaid, but due to their immigration status, do not actually qualify for the program. In a sense, this is a last resort program that helps offset the costs to providers who see these individuals in their emergency situations. EMA typically would cover people with immigration status of undocumented or non-immigrant, or people who are lawfully present in the country that are non-citizens that are sponsored immigrants. You have to have a basis of eligibility for the program, meaning you have to fit one of the existing Medicaid eligibility categories, and you have to meet all of the Medicaid eligibility requirements associated with that basis. And importantly, you have to have a medical emergency that requires you to receive care. Prior to January 1st of 2012, services that were covered under the medical assistance program really were any medically necessary service that was for the treatment of an emergency medical condition that would have otherwise been covered under medical assistance and was not for a service that is specifically prohibited in the federal regulations covering emergency medical care. Those examples of that would be organ transplants or prenatal care. during the, there was some question, I think, during the 2011 session, questions that were raised around the extent of the coverage that was being provided and how well that meshed with the federal criteria regarding this program. And during the session, a change was enacted that aligned the definition of emergency medical condition made it more closely aligned with the definition provided under federal regulations. The change that occurred as of January 1st of 2012 is that coverage for services under this program are now based upon verifying a medical emergency exists, and it limited coverage to the places of service that treat medical emergencies, namely emergency rooms and inpatient hospitals. As a result, services covered under EMA, if they are medically necessary to treat an emergency, and have to meet at least one of the following. Services that are delivered in an emergency room or by an ambulance service that are directly related to a medical emergency or medical condition. Services that are delivered in an inpatient hospital setting following admission from an emergency room or a clinic for an acute medical emergency. Or follow-up services that are directly related to the original service and provided to treat the emergency medical condition and would be covered by the global payment made to the provider. What the statute does in the law that was changed in 2011 really went in and clarified a number of services that are not covered under the Emergency Medical Assistance Program. It was very explicit about certain services not being provided, and that was really the main statutory change that occurred. The DHS has gone about implementing the statute change, and in particular, when we looked at the statute and began to do the implementation pieces of it, we realized that there were certain individuals whose care is pretty intricately combined with the site of where that care occurs. In particular, there are some individuals who are home-based or are in nursing facilities receiving care. The place of service where they're actually receiving that care is pretty closely linked to the care that they're actually receiving. And so there was a limited exception put in place that's consistent with, we believe, the federal and state requirements for payment of care related to the medical condition that the emergency medical condition has. And so that limited exception allows EMA to cover certain nursing facility services and home care services for persons who meet all of the following criteria. The person had a medical emergency. A medical condition that was covered by EMA and was discharged to the nursing facility or home and community setting directly from the emergency department or inpatient hospital, that the continuing treatment of the emergency medical condition is necessary in a nursing facility or home and community-based setting, and that the treatment and services provided in the nursing facility or home and community setting are directly responsible for preventing an emergency medical condition from immediately arising. Specifically, that was defined as treatments and services that must be such that if they were to be discontinued, the person's cardiovascular or respiratory condition would reasonably be expected to result within 48 hours in placing the person's health in serious jeopardy or causing serious impairment to bodily functions or serious dysfunction of any bodily organ or function. DHS communicated the changes that occurred in the law as well as the limited exception. We mailed a notice to EMA recipients, about 2,300 enrollees, on November 29th, and information about the EMA changes was also provided to counties, to tribes, to healthcare providers, and to community organizations. There is an appeal process in any Medicaid program. A recipient can appeal a reduction in benefits at any point. That's part of federal law. For recipients who filed an appeal of the benefit reduction that occurred in the law, consistent with federal and state law, their benefits do continue at their previous level through that appeal process. In the case of the changes that were made to the Emergency Medical Assistance Program, a timely appeal appeals that were received prior to the implementation of the law on January 1st. Notification was mailed in late November. person's had a month to appeal. If they appealed prior to the law change, their benefits continue as appeals go through the process. Just to give you a little bit of background on those appeals, just so you're aware of what the facts information is, approximately 267 individuals did appeal on a timely basis, and so they're still being covered under the program. And approximately 115 have submitted for the limited exception process. The limited exception process is fairly limited because it does cover nursing and home care, nursing home and home care services. Four of those have been approved. Just so you are just a little bit of background, just so people understand, there are about 2,500 enrollees in the program currently. Most of those are in the 7-county metro area. About 90% of the enrollees are in the 7-county metro area. But most counties in the state do have somebody who was a recipient of emergency medical assistance. About 2/3 of the enrollees are Hennepin County individuals. Mr. Chair, with that, that's the broad background on the program and on our implementation of the changes.
Okay, and for those who came late, the Mr. Lights has to go. And so if you have a question for him, those are in order now, and Ms. Dorfman's going to come next if she's here, because she has to go also. We're going to hold the other testimony on this to the end so we can use all the time we have left for this topic, is my intention. So any questions for Mr. Lights? You're good to go, I guess. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Dorfman, are you here? And just also, we're not acting on a bill today. This is, have a chair. And so today, this is informational work and some testimony. So, Ms. Dorfman, welcome to the committee, and do you both have to go?
Thank you. No. Thank you, Chair Abler and members of the committee. I'm joined by our Director of Human Services, Dan Engstrom, in case you have any questions. He's smarter than I am.
Okay, I got it.
So thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about emergency medical assistance and how we think it's going to impact Hennepin County. And I just want to tell you about one person. We have a 24-year-old Hennepin County resident in a nursing home receiving EMA for his care. When he was 16, he was in a terrible auto accident through no fault of his own and ended up on a feeding tube in a non-responsive state, and he's in a nursing home. He needs 24-hour care and supervision. And someone from his family, and both of his parents work and pay taxes, and they visit him on a regular basis nearly every day, we were told, by the nursing home. So this young man was one of the 1,400 that was mentioned, residents in Hennepin, who received a letter about the change in their benefits. But we're particularly concerned about a subset of that group, 300 residents who have chronic conditions that require some kind of specialty care, ongoing care. They're unlikely to meet the threshold for the limited exception, and they don't qualify for other benefits. EMA is their only resource. And while you think that this young man I mentioned would qualify for an exception, he does not. He has already been denied something about he doesn't need a tracheotomy tube, and his family has appealed that decision. Others in this group of 300 that we're worried about are another 40 people also in nursing homes, three quadriplegics who need 24-hour care, several folks in ICMFR, intermediate care facilities with disabilities, 33 people with kidney disease requiring dialysis, 30 with cancer on chemo, and others with HIV, AIDS, dementia, serious mental illness, or who require personal care attendance. Most have filed appeals with DHS, but we don't think many of them will win their appeals. We think less than 10%. So the likely outcome for this young man in the car accident is that the nursing home will ship him to Hennepin County Medical Center when his appeal runs out and the benefits are stopped. And then the nursing home will refuse to take him back unless someone assures them that they're going to get paid for his care. And HCMC, and as well as some of the other hospitals in Hennepin, will be forced to absorb the bill for millions of dollars in unreimbursed expenses for nursing home patients, chemo and dialysis treatments, and other specialty care for people who really have nowhere else to turn, while taxpayers still pick up the tab. Of the, as was said earlier, of the $44.5 million spent on EMA in Minnesota last year, over half of that went to residents living in Hennepin. The benefit change is estimated to result in a savings to EMA for Hennepin County clients alone of about $10 million annually. But these costs don't disappear. They transfer to the county. And while it could be a direct cost shift of that $10 million. It could well be more, because we're not likely to see the same number of clients getting the same services in the same settings. The hospital is, of course, the most expensive site for care. And we fear that many people will forego care, show up at the emergency room even sicker. While that visit may be reimbursed, their continued care after discharge will be uncertain, the reimbursement for that. Some people will see ER care deemed non-emergent, like dialysis, and the hospital won't be reimbursed for that care. And nursing home patients could become permanent hospital patients unless Hennepin County taxpayers cover the cost of the nursing home care. And in the end, we could all be paying more for care provided in the least appropriate setting. So this is a problem for all of us. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak today, that you're holding this informational hearing today. And we hope to work with the legislature, with the governor, and with DHS to come up with a solution. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. And not to be disrespectful, we're going to come to order now. So we have our quorum.
Seemed a little disrespectful.
Anyway, questions for Ms. Dorfman? Question? Go to McDonald.
Thank you, Ms. Dorfman. Since this program is for the emergency medical assistance, and this gentleman that you spoke about, of course, we want to help him as much as we can. Is there other state programs, and perhaps this could be for our staff as well, that could fill in where this has been taken out?
Well, when we first heard about this change, the first thing we did is try to identify all of our residents who would be impacted, and immediately to figure out if there are other alternative benefits that they would be eligible for. And for some of them, they could move to MinCare. Others really just receive, of the 1,400, may have just gotten one healthcare episode or a little bit of help during the year, so they're not as much of a concern. For these 300, we've run out of options. We're really looking everywhere we can. There's, so far of the appeals made, three have received an exception from DHS. And so this is the end of the road for these folks. This is all they get and all they're eligible for.
Preston Franson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Here we are looking to government for health care to solve our health care issues, and we have people not being covered because of insurance reasons or reasons of, you know, they don't qualify for this, they're falling through the cracks. But what we should be doing for these people is looking to charity. And there are doctors out there that actually want to provide charity care, but because of the rules that are written into Minnesota law, they are unable to do so. So I will be pursuing some sort of legislation to give doctors the tools needed in order to provide charity care. And so if anybody's interested in working on this, I'd greatly appreciate it, because I believe that Minnesota needs to get government out of the way of healthcare and let the doctors do what is best. And, you know, if they want to provide charity care, we should allow that to happen. So thanks.
Representative Carrie Blair, I just want to mention that Hennepin County Medical Center provided $17 million of charity care last year, as well as our clinic system, which also saw a number of people who weren't able to pay.
Representative Liebling, I think you get the last question for this witness.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask Ms. Dorfman, the case that you were talking about, if there was a physician or a group of physicians willing to give this particular patient charity care, would that take care of it? I think you described the situation that this young man is in a nursing home, et cetera. So how much of the problem would be covered if the physicians donated their services?
Ms. Dorfman.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Liebling, Representative Liebling. Obviously, we haven't sort of looked case by case and talked to physicians yet. We've certainly had a number of conversations with the nursing home that provides care today for this young man, and they've made it really clear that he's doing really well there, but they can't continue to provide care for him without the reimbursement. And so they're unwilling, they just don't have the capacity to provide charity care. And he needs 24-hour supervision and care. Not all of that are medical services provided by physicians. In fact, most of it is not. And so it's that level of care that, we'd have to pick up the costs, or he ends up in the hospital at 5-6 times the cost of staying in the nursing home.
And there is one other question, but I want just a one that you can actually help me figure out later if you want. The program went from $44 million all funds in 2011 to $50 million, it's state and federal match, 50-50 or thereabouts, to 50-something million in 2012 to $55 million in 2013. Can you tell me from your view how many emergencies have increased in that time and just explain? And I'm running out of time for this segment, but can you think about that and get back to me, because I really want to know the answer. Do you want to offer a quick opinion, sir? And say your name since you haven't testified yet.
Mr. Chairman, Dan Engstrom, Human Services Director in Hennepin County. As we've seen much of our caseload increase in the county overall, we've also seen an increase in our emergencies. I would have to get back to you.
Yeah, okay, if you would do that. And Representative Hamilton has a question, and then we're going
to
move.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry to bring this up now. However, I didn't hear it being addressed. And I understand that there's individuals on both sides of this issue, and it can be very contentious. And I thank you for allowing me to ask the question. In here, there was language as far as addressing individuals who would be considered undocumented. Yeah. And as far as their health care coverage or lack thereof. I serve a very diverse population where I'm at, of course. And I'm just wondering, not the rights and the wrongs, if you will, but what were the implications of the language change? And what avenues do the individuals who would be considered as undocumented, what are their avenues? I've heard some stories where people have been on dialysis and have been removed and stuff like that. And I know that some would say, you know, go back home or whatever the case may be. I'd just like to know, what are the implications of our actions? And if you could just address that.
Ms. Dorfman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, you know, and I've looked at a number of the cases and read their descriptions, and there are people from all over. There was a woman from England that has dementia, and she's impacted by this. And the young man I talked about was from Mexico. His family is from Mexico. His family's been here for a long time. As I said, his parents are working. And so, I mean, the bottom line is this language change largely impacts people who are undocumented. We don't know exactly, if you look at the 1,400 folks in Hennepin County that receive some EMA support, we think about 80% of them are undocumented. And they don't really have any other resource. And obviously, some services like pregnancy will continue to be covered. But for this group, particularly the group of 200 to 300 that I mentioned, they have nowhere else to turn other than to show up at the emergency room at one of the hospitals. And we think many of them will show up at HCMC, and we can't turn them away. I mean, we, by federal law, we have to accept them, and we can't discharge them to the streets if the nursing home, for example, won't have them back.
And Mr. Chairman,
yeah,
I've been a huge supporter of comprehensive immigration reform. I mean, this is a bigger issue than what we are going to tackle here. I just want to understand, once again, I've been a supporter of the DREAM Act and things like that, trying to give individuals an avenue to be brought to the surface, if you will, you know. Put those in quotations. Again, I just want to understand here, because this is something that's bigger than what we can tackle here, and I understand a lot of this is a federal issue that needs to be addressed as well, but again, I just want to fully understand the implications of my actions.
Thanks, and Ms. Dorfman, you have one more question, and that is the last one on this segment, so Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here, Commissioner Dorfman, and my comment is really for the Chair. And I can feel already in this brief hearing on this issue that this is going to be a challenge for us as a committee. And we're all going to have to use our restraint, and I will as well. But having practiced med-surg nursing and having taken care of people who are in renal failure and in the hospital for dialysis, you know, for weeks until they're discharged into dialysis in a clinical setting instead of in hospital setting, and having taken care of patients who are undergoing chemotherapy, The idea that charity care from some physicians, while very generous, will solve this problem is inaccurate. I think this is a this issue is a demonstration of what happens if we focus specifically on the words. And when we think about EMTALA at a federal level, providers are required to provide care in emergencies. And oftentimes I'll hear colleagues of mine say, you know, we have universal coverage because people can go to an emergency room. We've been working on reform for years in Minnesota to try and drive people out of hospitalization and out of the emergency room because that's where it's expensive. And this policy is going in the opposite direction. And when we focus just on emergencies, as we are with this population, you can see where there's no safety net and there isn't charity care to replace the necessary care for these people. We're either going to shift the cost to the property taxpayers, or we're by default saying these people can suffer on their own and perish. That will be the result of this issue if we don't tend to it. We need a safety net. Government is important as a safety net provider. I just disagree with Representative Franson, and I will be respectful about that, and we'll discuss that. But I don't think that we can expect providers to pick up the slack for the work that we should be doing. We tried that in GAMC. We know what happened to people. They didn't get care. We need to own up to our obligation in this. Thank you.
I'll take that as a statement. I know what Representative Franson is working on. Some of the clinicians have found themselves bound from doing charity care. There's some dentists in Rochester that have the same challenge with that from last time. And so I appreciate Representative Murphy, your words. And I think you made your point pretty clear, and there'll be more time for that today, Ms. Dorfman, and Mr.
Engstrom,
you'll be around yet today for, you, do you have to go to?
We have a county board meeting.
Well, I'm glad you could at least say hello, then. Thank you very much. And this topic will not be closed at the end of today. And so now we have three other topics, and I think we are optimistic getting them all in, but if the waiver update, oh, because they're all local. Yeah, I think let's move to the people that came from out of town. So let's, if we can get to them, we will. But we'll do the County Service Delivery Authority. They all traveled, I know. So, if Kate Lerner, Chris Sorensen, Terry Smith, and Charity Flohn would like to come up and tell us that. The waiver people, if you're out of, I think you're all local here. So. Anyway, so if you can do that, somebody please come down. Hi. You can start. And so we're going to spend 15 minutes on this topic. You can spend the time highlighting. I want an update, and I'd like to know where the snags are. Some people met with me already, so I'm interested in this. So, and if you also just in the 15 minutes want to mention some of the reforms that are going on beyond the SDA, but just in that time frame, because at 1:13 we'll be done with this segment. So
okay.
Like a TV show, you know.
Right. Thank you.
Well, welcome to the committee, yeah.
My name is Kate Lerner. I'm the Director of County Relations for the Department of Human Services. Thanks for the opportunity to talk today about a lot of the work that's been going on with county redesign as a result of the State-County Results Accountability and Service Delivery Redesign Act that passed initially in 2009. It has been subsequently amended. But I'd like to just take a brief minute to give some background on what this act is all about, what its intent was, and then I'd like to spend the bulk of our 15 minutes allowing our county representatives to talk about some of the work that they've been doing. So very quickly, as a recap, I think the name of the act itself actually says it all. It really requires the Department of Human Services, in partnership with counties and many others, to do three key things. The first one is to identify the specific results that we expect our counties to achieve as our local service delivery partners. The second piece that this act intends to accomplish is to define how counties will be held accountable for achieving those results, and also afford to the Commissioner of Human Services a process for remedying when counties are not making adequate progress toward those expected outcomes or those expected goals. And then the third thing this act is really intended to do is to create a certification process that counties can voluntarily choose to pursue to become certified as what's called a service delivery authority. And this is a new structural model of service delivery that counties can pursue that many counties might be interested in pursuing depending on the specific needs within their local community. And I think there have been some really valuable lessons that we've learned as we in the department have worked in partnership with counties to implement this act over the last couple of years. And I think the first thing is that the passage of this legislation has in a lot of ways served as a catalyst to really move, I think, create a culture shift, if you will. I think one of the things that is really critical if we are going to be successful in coming up with new service delivery models that are more sustainable and address some of the challenges that we're facing right now, it's really about, first and foremost, creating a culture shift in the mindset of those of us working within the system to understand how important it truly is that we make some changes and why those changes are important. And I think passage of this legislation did a really nice job of really helping to almost serve as a turning point, if you will, to help both counties and the department understand the importance of really making some of these redesign changes. The other piece that I think is a really important lesson that we've learned as we've implemented this is the importance of really understanding what the specific outcomes that we're trying to achieve and assuring that those desired outcomes are driving our redesign changes. In other words, really being clear about what is it that we're trying to achieve for clients, what is it that we're trying to achieve for our communities as a whole, and then really working to redesign our systems in both structural and programmatic ways that really help us to achieve those specific outcomes. And I think the Performance Steering Committee, which is the group that was charged in this piece of legislation with actually developing the specific results and performance measures that counties across the state will be held accountable for achieving, they have done a tremendous amount of work over the last couple of years to really arrive at what those results and performance measures should be, ultimately leading to a recommendation to you all at the end of 2012 here. I think it's that work that's done a lot to push counties and the department to more substantive conversation, if you will, about the kind of redesign that we need to see happen. And in a lot of counties across this state, that conversation has led to some considerable actions that I think we'd like to spend some time talking with you about today. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chris Sorensen, who is the Director of Southwest Health and Human Services, to talk a bit more about the efforts that have gone on in his region.
Welcome to the committee, and if the other testifiers want to kind of feather in, we've got about 10 minutes between the three of you. So I'm glad you're here, and we're all ears in private as well, but I'm glad you're here today. So tell us your name, please, and give us your thoughts.
Yes, Christopher Sorensen. I'm the Director of Health and Human Services for Southwest Health and Human Services. And just for background, it's Lincoln, Lyon, Murray, Pipestone, and Rock counties that are a part of this joint powers. And I would be mindful of the time. My colleagues have a much bigger project than ours. But I want to thank, Mr. Chair, you and the committee and the legislature. The SDA opened up doors for counties to begin the grinding of a new reality in health and human services. One, that we were fragmented, so to speak, especially in our part of the state with small counties, separated by health and human services. So the design elements that went into this for us is really how do we build upon what's been done in the past. And in Lincoln, Lyon, and Murray counties, there was a multi-county health and human services entities that go back to 1973 and 78 when the Joint Powers Act was originally passed. And so the direction from our commissioners was to establish our ability in a rural environment that's had a tremendous amount of population shift and population loss so that we might have sustainable services to offer our residents in the future. And to do it in a way that fiscally we can help sustain it as well and provide internal controls that will allow us to allow us to create revenue that's not levy dependent by getting the best outcomes possible. So the SDA put this put this out there for us. We used the Joint Powers Act because it was something that was readily available and I think well understood from our local commissioners. And they really had to rally behind this idea. And it takes, like Kate had mentioned, it takes a lot of important work at the ground level with our commissioners and with our stakeholders, recipients of service, to help them through design process. Because there is a lot of hurdles that can get in the way. We know that we have to work through the agreements and the language with our labor unions. We know that we have to deal with the legal entity itself. And we feel like that we've been able to accomplish that now. We joined Health and Human Services, two independent JPAs, in 2011, January 1st. And January 1st of this year, Rock County joined us for Health and Human Services. And we're underway with a new project with Redwood County as well. So it's one of those things that the work of the commissioners to get to the point where we can provide them with the data that's driving those outcomes, that we can provide those sustainable services, that we can do it in a way that doesn't burden the taxpayer with additional or heavy levy costs, and we can do it and keep the high touch and specialized services that have developed even in a rural environment. And so that those elements, along with the ability to increase our access and use of technology to cooperate over a large geographic area, was also a big piece of that. So, again, my colleagues have a lot to say about their project, and I can turn over the rest of the time for questions or for my colleagues.
Well, Mr. Sorensen, you and your two county partners are to be commended for paving the way in pretty much unknown territory. Kind of exciting along the way, I know, but I think that you're absolutely on the right track and deserve better, so thanks for coming. And any questions for Mr. Sorensen? And the members can chat with you afterward as well. So we'll welcome to the committee, and you can have, like, you know, 3 minutes each, and then we'll have a couple comments. And welcome. And I know you can't do justice to your topic in 3 minutes, but it's an update. It's not not a bill. It's how's it going, and I know it's very successful with your work, so introduce yourself, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm Terry Smith from Wabasha County Social Services. As you know, our counties in southeast Minnesota are on a little bit different avenue than southwest. And as 12 counties, we've been, along with other counties in the state, we're always looking at ways to become more efficient and to save taxpayer dollars. So this project grew out of an effort to say, well, why aren't we as counties in southeast Minnesota looking at combining services? What can be done to become more efficient? And that's where this really grew out of. And this began for us back in the summer of 2008 and has just kept on going from then. As you also might know, in small counties, we don't have the resources to pull the planning people together. So we were fortunate enough to find some grant funding from the South, from Rochester Area Foundation, and eventually the Bush Foundation, to help us moving forward in the planning process. So we've been putting a lot of time into this whole process to study what we do, how we do it, and where we're going to go, and how it might look in the future. As you can imagine, working with 12 county boards also has its challenges. We do not have unanimous opinions that we should be going forward on this. Some boards are mixed on how we should go forward. And for us, that's fine, because we need to be held accountable also. Will this work? Will it not? We are now to the point where we are all, as counties, moving forward, gathering data, and trying to come to some good business decisions on moving this forward. And with that, I should turn this over to Charity.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Charity Flynn. I'm the Director of Human Services in Steele County. And committee members, I would draw your attention to the handout that I saw was just passed out. This is just to give you an idea of where we are in this process. As Terry said, this started back in 2008. We did an awful lot of work in developing the blueprint, which is on the second page of your handout. We had a number of stakeholder group meetings, bringing together county staff, agencies that we contract with, clients that we provide services to, advocacy groups that we work with, to say, if we could redesign human services, what might that look like? What would be the vision? How would we move that forward? And through those discussions and that activity, we came up with the blueprint. This is where we think we want to go. And now we're in the process of how do we actually design it? It's one thing to have the vision. It's another to operationalize it. How do we figure out exactly what we're going to do? And across the 12 counties, there's a lot of things that we do in common. There's many things we all must do. And part of the challenge there in our various size counties, because we have some very small counties, we have a very large county, is having the expertise and the skill set to do all of the things that we're required to in some of the smaller counties. So our thought is are there ways that we can have maybe two or three experts across the region working on some specific activities as opposed to each having to duplicate some of them? So through the funding from the Bush Foundation as well as county contributions, we've been contracting with Accenture to help us really step back and look at what we're doing. And this has really been kind of an exciting process. It's the first time we've really done that type of a deep analysis of all of our programs all at the same time and tried to pull it together. So we're in that kind of design phase now. All of our counties, our information was due last Friday at 5 o'clock. You've got that all in. Now they're putting together what might the operational model look like. Where might there be savings? Where are there efficiencies that we can deal with? When we look at some counties have some very unique features to them. We have lots of things we do in common, but for instance, in Steele County, I'm responsible for the public transportation system. I'm the only county in southeastern Minnesota that falls into human services. Some have veterans, some have corrections, so there's some differences between the counties. So we've been doing the design. Implementation would be the next step. There's a timetable in your handout. We're looking, as I said, the materials was due on Friday. Now they're going to come out and do the teams from Accenture one-on-one visits with each of the counties to delve a little deeper to find out what are the differences, where are the challenges, how do we put this together. We hope to have kind of a final model really by the end of February, beginning in March, and then allow the counties an opportunity to kind of step back and take a look at it and say, what about this fits for us, and do we want to move forward? So we'll kind of have a go, no-go decision sometime end of March into April, and then figure out how do we move this forward, and which of our 12 counties, if all or some, are actually moving forward. So in this operating model, we're taking a look, what is the county experience and expertise? What do we bring to the table? What is it that the blueprint demonstrated for us as where we want to really go? Pulling together the actual data, what is it that we're doing and how are we doing it? As well as using some industry-leading practices, which is something that Accenture brings to the table, too, in terms of what else is happening across the country and in other areas that might be applicable to this. Pull all of that together into our redesign discussion and ultimately our operating model. We also talked about the different components. We're looking for the vision of the future. What are the practices and processes? We want to make sure we're looking at best practice, not just doing what we've always done because we've always done it, but is there another way of doing it? The organizational model, the technology, that's been a huge issue for us to be looking at. There's a lot of things we could do more effectively with the ability to maximize the technology that we have across the region. We're also looking at the infrastructure and the facilities. If we change and shift things from one county operation to another, what's the impact on the county as a whole, as well as in the individual human service or community services departments? We're certainly trying to keep our staff involved in this process and informed about what we're doing and how we're going about it. In terms of data gathering, we're looking at what are the metrics, what is it we're doing. Certainly the enabling legal framework is very helpful for us to figure out how are we going to move this forward, and then ultimately how do we fund it as we move forward. And also in your handouts are our vision statement and some of the guiding principles that we're operating on. I won't read through those, but certainly want those available for your review. I know I talked really fast. Are there questions?
I appreciate it. It's hard to pack thousands of man hours into 8 minutes, isn't it?
Yeah, it
is. That's when Slawick has a question or a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, first of all, thank you. Thank you for your work and for your good thinking and for your vision on this. You know, we go to national meetings, and Minnesota's kind of in the minority of this, the county rule. You know, at least that's what we hear. And it does make everything more complicated. So I just, if one of you want to answer, eventually, is it all going to come back to the state? It makes me wonder, do you think there'll be maybe four regions in the state, or will they be state services? Two areas that have come up in the past are welfare investigators, whether that should be more bumped up to the state. So do you think some of your things ultimately may come back to the state? And the CCAP program potentially moves from the counties up to the state level. I mean, do you see that happening and potentially going back to a statewide system?
So one of you can comment on that. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I think what you're asking is probably true. It could happen. When we start looking at some of the services that we provide, child support as a good example, that's what we'd call a low-touch service. A lot of those interactions can be done by computer, can be done via web cameras for the court process, everything else. That could become an easy state process. And to that goal, our counties are already involved in a pilot project trying to develop that in southeast Minnesota.
And I was actually thinking the same thing, and I'm sorry we're so out of time. You're thinking about the redesign piece. I think by the efforts of the Lincoln Lyon Murray Group and then the 12 that are represented here, that stops it from becoming statewide. If organically counties with a mutual interest decide to team together and deal with it, you avoid the metro and then the non-metro region or something is what it was devolved to. And I really appreciate your work and my interest, having supported Rep. Thiessen's work in the beginning, which started off the SDA thing and me piling on later and the committee agreeing. As where's the snags? What do you need yet? If you need, not today, but just what gaps are there in the JPAs that help it not go as far as you want? I thought by relieving some mandates in the SDA piece with outcomes at the end that you can solve them your own ways and give flexibility. If I missed something, let me know. I had a meeting this week with some of the people doing the outcomes. They said, give us some time. So maybe doing nothing is better for the moment, but just help us along the way because we are from the state and we do want to help. And so that's just my comment to you, and thanks for driving all the way that you all did. It really is very good to have you here. So thank you.
Thanks much.
Thank you.
And then we'll talk to the tribes next, the White Earth Social Services transition thing. And just for the, just doing, oh yeah, we will. And so they want to kind of gather up here. Just to announce, we are going to defer the waiver update. We were just overzealous in our thinking that would all fit today. And I apologize to those who came to hear that. I will be rescheduled. While they're coming, who wants to do the minutes? Epson Hamilton had a question today, so he gets to do the minutes. He moves the minutes. Any questions about those, comments, testimonials? All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? They're adopted. We also have to do... if you can... Yeah, it's kind of loud. We also have to do this memo about the bonding thing. Did you all see this in your... Are you... we're only going to ratify the work of Mr. Lear and his crew, such as it was. This is the ballots. They've been certified by Mr. Lear. He'll testify that these are an accurate count. I think that they do tell a story about the focus of the committee. And I know what happened on the other side. We didn't caucus this for a minute. And so this is just members voting what they thought. I think it's kind of healthy. And for the people just listening, has this been public? Is this out? Did this get out? Do the people have this done? If you want a copy of the bonding results, it's posted on the electronic site. But anyway, the system-wide preservation got the most votes. The $40 million redesign got the second most, and then it was the grave markers and the Maplewood Tubman Center project. And then it was MSOP, and then it was the Washburn thing, and then the early childhood. They were all approved, some by narrow margins, some by overwhelming margins, which I think will tell them what we want them to know. So anyway, we were to take a vote, and now we have to vote the report out as it is. Any questions about this? Yeah, Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, just being I think I'm still a freshman, even though it's our first term, second session.
You are still a freshman.
What's the next? Am I still in?
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Gottwald.
Good point.
Then I should not ask any dumb questions.
That's your question.
All right, I'm done. No, what's the next step then? We vote this out, as you said, and then do we have an opportunity to present each case to us and ask questions again?
No.
Okay.
This is it. This is the end of the bonding topic for our committee. They can come in your office, and you can ask them whatever you want to ask.
But then this
is our report to the bonding committee, and then they will consider all our considerations and other considerations, which are many. I used the word ether before describing the method. And they may not take our recommendations at all, but this is our recommendation. We all took our votes, and And anyway, any more questions about that? So I will just, all in favor, I guess it's my motion that we send this off to the bonding committee. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Very good. I'm against the report. Okay, then. I do want to welcome you all from the White Earth Tribe and the department. And the chairman. Okay. Well, thank you. It's really nice to have you here. It's seldom that we get together. I wish we had a lot more time. We have 15 minutes to hear from you. And, 20? Oh, you have 20, excuse me. And then we'll spend the balance of time on the emergency medical assistance topic. But I'm really happy you're here. I'm honored by your presence. For the people that were following along, we decided in the last bill to give the White Earth Tribe the chance to carry on its own social service function on its on the reservation in total and the transition plan. And so it's going well. There's a few snags, and any good plan has snags. We heard about that from the county, so I'm not going to burn up any more of your time, but this is an update, and they'll talk, and there'll be time for a few questions, and so thank you very much. And who's going to start?
I will.
Oh, go ahead, yeah.
Thank you, Commissioner. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Irma Visner, and I'm the tribal chairwoman, White Earth Tribe. Have with me Monty Fox, our health director, and Vern LaPlante from the Department of Human Services. I'm sorry, ma'am.
And Barry.
And Barry from the Department of Human Services. I thank you for the opportunity to present our report today. Last year, in the last legislative session, thank you for the passage of the legislation to allow the White Earth Tribe to assume social services, human services, responsibilities from the county to the tribe. We have since that time had a number of meetings that has included a team from the Department of Human Services and the tribe. And we have, since Menominee County obviously is impacted, we have invited the county as well. The report that we have has been, I will turn it over to Vern LaPlante to go through our report. Vern was one of the writers for the report, and Monty Fox, our health director, facilitated the process between the tribe and the county and the state Department of Human Services. The compelling reason requesting and receiving and having the legislation approved for this transfer is that Menominee County is unique in that it is entirely within the exterior boundaries of the White Earth Reservation. And way back in 1867, our reservation, our homeland, was established by treaty. So it is our responsibility as a sovereign tribal government to assume the responsibilities of providing services to our constituents. That's what this legislation is about, and that's what this report is about. On the other hand, the reasons are very good, that very, very compelling, in that this will save the state of Minnesota funds, money, and the services will be provided more efficiently, and the tribe has the infrastructure. I don't want to sound boastful or anything like that, in all due respect for the county, but the tribe has the infrastructure and the capacity that that it is capable of doing this much more efficiently and cost-effectively than the county is. So with that, I want to thank Commissioner Jessen, Department of Human Services, and her wonderful staff for facilitating and working with us as a team to compile this report and to make the progress we've done so thus far.
Go ahead. Mr. Chairman.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Ann Berry, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I'm here, first of all, to remind you of the report that was required by the legislature. Hopefully you all have copies of that. And the legal responsibility to, uh, or the the transfer of the legal responsibility of human services and social services to the White Earth Nation. We've, as Chairman Visner has said, we've made much progress. This report details that progress. We have hit a couple of, as the Chairman has suggested, a couple of snags, some that are definitional. How do you describe tribal members and their families? And so as we work through each one of those, it's clear that we are working together, not just with the White Earth Nation, but also the county, because there's an impact, really, to county social services and human services as well. I'm here today because the department continues to support this process, continues to support this legislation, and we'll do everything we can to make sure that that transfer takes place in a way that provides for good outcomes for people who are tribal members and family members of the White Earth Nation. So I will turn it over to Vern and Monty, who are going to talk a little more about the process and some of the things that are in the report and what's next.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you. Nice to have you back after the bill got passed. So I know we worked hard to get it done before, so I'm very happy to be here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Vern LaPlante. I'm the Director of Indian Policy at the Department of Human Services, and I'm grateful to be here today. As Chairwoman Visner and Deputy Commissioner Berry stated, the legislation is really key in terms of moving us forward in a new direction here at the state, where we are beginning to recognize the tribe as a key component of the infrastructure within the state of Minnesota to provide health and human services. And they've been doing this for a number of years, and as we work with them, we learned a lot about the infrastructure that is in place, and we'll turn this over in a few minutes to Monty to share some of the information. But let me just share with you a little bit about the process that we engaged in to kind of arrive in the development of the report and a couple pieces that we figure are still some outstanding issues that we need to continue to work on. First of all, we put a team together. Department of Human Services is a very we have a number of responsibilities, and so what we did is we pulled people from a number of business areas within the Department of Human Services to be a part of a core group along with White Earth Nation, and then we also invited representatives from Winoman County to participate with us. And we put a series of meetings together, probably 15 meetings, and had discussions about a number of things. We started out by really taking a look at what the responsibilities or the current responsibilities of the county are relative to the delivery of health and human services to people in Winoman County. So we just kind of did an inventory of that, and we also took some time to do an inventory also of the infrastructure and the type of programs that the tribe was administering at the same time, so that we could kind of see where we had capacity and where there were some gaps so we started out doing that. We also took a look at the finances that Winoman County expended on the provision of services, and then also just started taking a look at the numbers of people that White Earth will be assuming this responsibility for. White Earth came to us back in September, I believe it was, and shared with us at that time, Chairwoman Visner shared with us the vision of the White Earth Nation in terms of assuming this responsibility and also the commitment to do so. At that time, she shared with us a implementation plan that was based on a kind of a phase-in approach at that particular time. The thought was that it's better to just get this thing going, implement on a smaller scale as we can move forward. And so they identified six areas that they felt were really critical to their needs at the time. So we started taking a look at that. But as we moved into this discussion a little bit, we ended up, Weyer took a closer look at it and realized that the some of the key programs that we had in terms of the more so that our income maintenance programs at Department of Human Services were really integral to the implementation of this program. So we reached a point in the research that we later decided that rather than just do a phase-in approach, they decided that it was more important for them to implement all at one time. And so this kind of where we're at this particular stage, we're taking a closer look at what that means. Recently, the last meetings that we had with the county commissioners our county commissioner, chair of the Board of Commissioners at Manoman County, and the tribe here shared some options to them or some implementation ideas to them, and I'm going to have Monty talk a little bit about that. But the chairperson from Manoman County was very committed to sitting with both DHS and the tribe and really taking a closer look at this. And what they did is invited both the department and the tribe to the next board meeting that they're going to have, and so we'll have that opportunity to share information with them. But I'm going to let Monty just kind of jump in here for a little bit just to share a little bit about the infrastructure that is in place at White Earth, but also then talk a little bit about the four options that you presented at the last meeting.
Welcome to the committee.
Yeah, my name is Monty Fox. I'm the Director of Health for the White Earth Nation. And as we kind of went through this process, we had kind of at first a phased approach. After we went through that phased approach, we started to realize that the phased approach was probably going to be the least effective approach in taking a look at this and getting this done, because all the information systems are tied to all the programs and not just a certain number, at least the six that we initially thought. So we had to probably look at the information systems as one of the key products that we're going to need to move this forward, as well as having access to those information systems, which we do not. And another key piece was that we would need the financial workers or eligibility specialists. So there was some expertise that we needed in that area. So we started to kind of look at these information systems as probably the key to making this work. So we did an inventory of the White Earth Nation and our information systems, and we found out that we had 29 people within our system that work with 11 of the state information systems. So we figured out we had the infrastructure. With those 29 people, it's roughly about 190 years of experience. So we figured, while we got the infrastructure, we're still going to need those. So we're going to have to change focus a little bit and handle this problem or this challenge a little differently. So what we did is we came up with four options at that point in time for our government to consider. And option one was 100% assumption of the Manoman County Human Service responsibilities for all residents of Manoman County. The only reason why we decided to put that as an option is because what will happen is we figure from some of the data that was collected with the state that about 70% of the Native American population is in Manoman County that uses the MA dollar. Which is 100% payback for the 638 public law 638 on the federal side. That's where our savings is going to be for the state, and that's also where we need to start moving forward and taking a look at that area. So if we put families in there, that's going to be additional percentage that's going to be on there. So if we look at a box, the inside of the box is the, say, 80%, and then we're only left with 20% on the outside. It doesn't leave the county much room or to really be taking care of services. So we thought that should be an option. The second option was 100% assumption of Manoman County services and responsibilities for White Earth members and their families, which the legislation allows us to do and move forward with. So we left that as option two. And then option three was suspending all of that assumption and responsibilities until we have those expertise people in place and being able to train our information system people to be able to access that information, as well as move forward and create the eligibility for our own nation. So that was option three. And then option four, of course, was just to continue with the initial plan. and the initial plan, the phased approach, and what we found out from preliminary things that we're doing was not the most effective approach. White Earth Nation is a big nation. We have approximately 42 nurses. Our mental health organization has 21 people that is involved in mental health. And we just recently had a proclamation, which our nation went forward with, and we have bumped up our CD treatment up to about around 60 people now. So we're a huge organization, just even in that area, whereas the county in the mental health area has two individuals, and the CD has one. So this really makes good sense for us to move forward with a project such as this. And Vern, you want to talk any more about that? Or
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think one of the key pieces that Monty is stressing here too is that as we examine the numbers of people that would be transferred over from Mahnomen County to White Earth, we recognize that left some infrastructure issues for Mahnomen County, and so we Chairwoman Visner and the Tribal Council proposed that the tribe may be interested in working with the tribe to even provide services to other members outside the legislation. And we're not, I know that's something that we will still have discussion, we'll still have with the board, but it also fits in with the SDA or the Service Delivery Authority as well. I won't go into that here too much, but I think the point that we're really looking at is that it's a significant transfer in terms of numbers of people from Mahnomen County to White Earth Nation, and the infrastructure we found is in place. Other than at this stage, there's a couple issues. One issue, as Monty identified, is the staff that would be administering the eligibility processing of eligibility determination, and then just the information systems to do so. So we still have some things that we need to take a closer look at, but we're optimistic that we're going to see implementation here. Don't have a date yet, but once we kind of get these couple of outstanding issues identified and researched a little bit more, we'll be in a better position.
Well, great, Ms. Berry.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I could just wrap up by saying we don't expect to need any legislation this session to continue making progress towards the goal of transferring social services and human services to the White Earth Nation, and that the legislation itself gives the commissioner broad authority to seek waivers at the federal level to actually implement this this requirement. So, at this point, we don't find anything that is insurmountable. Yeah. Moving forward.
Well, it's an exciting report. I do have one question. Mr. LaPlante or whoever, Public Law 638, or did you say it, Mr. Fox? Somebody, you're going to save some money. Does that give some federal match? Is that the part? Or you said you're going to save some money based on Public Law 638.
Yeah. What this just does, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Public Law 93638, basically what that is some federal authority that authorizes the tribe or the Indian Health Services to tap into 100% federal dollars to pay for health care for those individuals that are medical assistants. And so one of the things that we've done, and we've still got to dig a little bit deeper in terms of the data, but basically what's occurring is there's about $6 million, maybe $7 million of MA expenditures that are showing up by Mahnomen County. And those are a cost to the state of Minnesota of about $6 million.
All right.
Once we transfer over some of these individuals to the tribe, and the tribe begins administering that, we should be able to tap into the 100% federal funding.
Ms. Berry, when can I take that into my forecast savings? Anyway, we're just a few questions, but Ms. Repson Kiffmeyer, do you want to say something?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm impressed by page 14 and the amount of years of experience and the staff that you had. That was a very good piece of information. I think on the savings, though, I appreciate what you're saying in regards to that, but I look on page 12, the total costs and the total revenue. So my understanding from what you're saying, those two things would still be total cost, total revenue. What would change is that the state portion would come all from the federal government, and so the costs, I guess when I think of savings, I think of costs going down, not changing where the money comes from. So I appreciate what you're saying there, but that would be what I would look at. Maybe you want to comment on that, because I would think maybe you'd also be looking at some overall cost savings from the how you would structure this as well.
Does somebody want to react to that, Mr. Plant?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what we see here in terms of the numbers that you're looking at this particular stage, these are numbers that are relative to the total population that Mahnomen County is providing services to. We have not yet identified the actual number of people that will be transferred over, to White Earth and. So we're still working on that, but it'll be a percentage of that. It could be 70%. We're guessing right now that it's going to be somewhere around there. We will see a reduction in the cost to the state of Minnesota, potentially. I mean, we can't say for certain, but if we're able to access this 100% federal funding, that will occur.
Mr. LaPlante, I think what Representative Kiffmeyer is getting at is what I was hoping for as well. And I think you've given a very conservative projection of money, because you have to make sure there's enough if everything goes exactly as it ever was. My hope, and Representative Kiffmeyer's hope, if I speak for her correctly, is that by virtue of your culturally sensitive approach and being closer at hand and understanding circumstances in your special way, that people might need less services, you'd have stronger recoveries, less need for ongoing future care, et cetera, and it actually be total cost savings as well as savings to the state. So we're cheering for you about that. Mm-hmm. Nobody else is raising their hand. I just want to celebrate 30 seconds worth of what this is. It's, at the worst, you're going to phase it in, but something's it's not going to be the same. And, it's just a really cool moment. It's a cool time when we turn back something that you'll do well at, Chairwoman Visner, with your crack staff there. I've gotten impressed with what they have to offer and their dedication, the depth of your expertise. Seldom do we get to celebrate a moment like this. We have problems. People came before you. The two county groups are working on different ways to do their stuff. Before that, we had emergency medical assistance. We're going to go back to that and address that challenge. We mostly face challenges. We don't get to celebrate successful moments, so... You've honored us by coming today with your team, Ms. Berry on behalf of the department, Mr. McCorder, who's hiding back there, who's been a part of this, again, thousands of hours to make this happen, and many years of work, and so we just wish you well in this and celebrate the moment. So thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Anyway, thank you. We're going to go back to our earlier topic, and so... back to our agenda, actually, and so Mr. Engstrom has come and gone. So Mr. Scandrett, and then if is Mike, is he here? There he is. Yeah, I saw him. And then if Mikhail Pensek would come and sit next to him. And we have two other testifiers, Mr. Schmidt and Ms. DeFranco and Ms. Hardy. And so what I'd like to do... hopefully your comments can be in the brief range so we have some chance to chat and even make a panel out of you, perhaps, like we've done in the past. That's always kind of interesting. So,
is that what they were talking
about? Okay. So if you can take about 3 minutes for your comments, that'll actually burn up all the time with all of you, but I want to have a chance for a little bit of a dialogue. So this discussion is not over. There's not a bill in front of us. So with that... Mr. Scandrett, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Michael Scandrett, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition. And the Safety Net Coalition consists of healthcare providers that serve primarily low-income Minnesota Safety Net Coalition. And the Safety Net Coalition consists of healthcare providers that serve primarily low-income, uninsured, and disadvantaged populations. It's community health centers, the mental health centers, community dental clinics serving low-income people, and safety net hospitals and other providers. So as you can understand, the emergency medical assistance program is a pretty important issue for the community health centers, because they're required under federal law to serve all people regardless of their insurance status or income, and this is true of the other coalition members as well. So when there's a loss of a payment for them, it basically means that it's a cost to them and they're less able to serve other people that may be in need. And so I think that in part apologize to the committee because we might have been asleep at the wheel last summer and fall, and I think as a lot of other people apparently also were not fully aware of the consequences of the change from last year. And so we've kind of been looking at it since then and really looking at it regardless of your views on kind of how much money we should have for this particular program. It remains that it's a federally mandated program for the state, and the way that it was done last session is actually creates unintended consequences that none of us really understood at the time, because now it only covers emergency room and hospital services and some services and follow-up care. And the effect is, as we've learned, that there are people that are on dialysis, there are stroke victims that are in nursing facilities, there are people that have serious mental illness on psychiatric meds. And basically the effect of the program is if you stop doing all of those things, we all know where everybody's going to end up. They're going to end up in the emergency room, which is covered, and they're going to end up in the hospital, which is also covered, and then the hospitals won't have anywhere to discharge people to because the nursing homes won't be able to take them because they don't get paid. So it's really not what anybody intended, and I understand the committee needed to save some money, but there's probably a way to get the savings in some other ways. And so there's actually a pretty wide group of stakeholder groups that have been working a lot, meeting with the chair and others, meeting with DHS to try to come up with some sort of fix to the program that we could bring back to you later that really preserves the purpose of the program to really only cover the most serious medical conditions as is required by the federal government. To provide that as efficiently as possible, to use the lower cost outpatient community providers whenever we can, and to not have incentives that would drive people back into the most costly settings, which I don't think is consistent with anything that this committee and others have been trying to achieve in the various reforms. So right now we do have a very difficult situation with nursing homes that, as you all know, don't have a lot of extra money floating around, and some of them have very expensive patients now that they're not being paid for and have some real tough choices, and you're probably going to hear from some of them. You also, again, as we said, have the hospitals that are going to be, and for lack of a better word, warehousing patients because there's nowhere to discharge them to even after they're done receiving their inpatient hospital services. And so we would commit to you, we intend to continue to work on this over the next week or two. The chair has been clear about giving us a deadline for getting something back. And so our goal, again, is to come back with you with a solution that is in compliance with federal law. It tries to achieve the savings we need to achieve, and it's consistent with our other health care reform objectives. So
that's take good. Any Thanks, questions Mr. Scandrett. And is it Ryan? Could you pull a chair back so Ms. Hardy could sit up there next to the so Chantel, you want to sit next to them up there? A little panel thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we have Mr. Mikhail Pensek.
Yes.
And 2 or 3 minutes, and then we'll. So 2 minutes or 3 minutes okay. of comments, please. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Say your name and then.
My name is Mikhail Pensek. I'm here with the Minnesota Immigrant Rights Action Committee. Just here to speak out against this change in services. As has been mentioned, on January 1st, 2012, undocumented immigrants in Minnesota no longer qualify for many medical treatments. This means immigrants in Minnesota who receive chemotherapy, dialysis, diabetes management, and alcohol and drug treatment, among other things, are in danger of not receiving their treatments. For people receiving essential services like chemotherapy and dialysis, this is a matter of life and death. People can and will die from this if this isn't changed. Our understanding is that only services that will now be allowed for immigrants are medical emergencies treated in an emergency room or hospital and some very limited follow-up care. Undocumented immigrants cannot receive treatment for other medical and medical care that Human Services Department deems to be non-emergency. This new anti-immigrant policy was passed at the end of the legislative session in the middle of the night. It was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. Many people didn't notice this anti-immigrant change in the law until too late because legislators added a lot of things in at the last minute. The majority of legislators didn't even have the chance to read the final bills before having to vote on them. MIRAC denounces this new anti-immigrant law that could cause many people to needlessly die in Minnesota. Anti-immigrant policies such as this one are inhumane, attacking people who depend the most on medical services and care, the elderly, and people who suffer from life-threatening illnesses such as cancer and kidney disease. We denounce the fact that Minnesota's politicians chose to balance the state budget on the backs of immigrants who have serious illnesses. We call on you to take immediate action to reverse this, to assure that nobody in Minnesota dies from this inhumane law. In Minnesota, nobody should die of a disease when treatment is available just because of their immigration status. Having the wrong immigration status should not be a death sentence. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, and please stay there. We'll it's nice to have you testify. And the next person is Mr. Schmidt.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman.
Yeah, 2 minutes or so, or three, yeah.
Thanks for this opportunity. I'll be very brief. I know you've had a lot of testimony today. I did have a friend last night. I was talking to my friend, and I told him I was testifying today at the Capitol, and he says, geez, Ted, you've been doing that for a long time, haven't you? And I just went through something in my office today, and back in 1986, I was appointed by then-Governor Rudy Perpich to the Long-Term Care Health Planning Task Force, so I guess I've been advocating for older adults for many years, and it was then chaired by Junior Senator Linda Berglund, so I guess I go back a few years. Again, thank you for your time on this issue of emergency medical assistance. I am a nursing home administrator. I work for Serenity Care Center on Humboldt. That's the west side of St. Paul in Ramsey County. We also have residents who were on emergency medical assistance, and we have two in our care center. And I couldn't agree with you more, Representative Murphy, about the chronic medical conditions of these residents. One of them is on hospice and is on a terminal condition. She has Alzheimer's and very cognitively impaired. One of them has a serious stroke, is on medications to prevent blood clotting. We provide the care to these individuals at a very cost-effective manner. And without these services, they can and probably will end up in the hospital emergency room, as you've heard earlier, which is extremely expensive. Both of these residents, and I'm sure a lot of these individuals, have no or limited family support. I guess I'm asking you to, you and your colleagues, to reevaluate this legislative policy addressing emergency medical assistance for these older adults in Minnesota. Thank you very much.
And thank you for your testimony, and thanks for being such a veteran. And now we have Kim DeFranco. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Kim DeFranco. I'm from the Welfare Rights Committee. And thank you for hearing my testimony today. We are here to testify on a very bad provision of the Health and Human Services Bill that was passed in the wee hours of July 20th in 2011. Shortly before the session was gaveled to a close, under this current law, funding for immigrants, dialysis, chemotherapy in nursing homes, and other basic survival cares and services will be cut off. But I think it also highlights that even more and more people will be denied basic survival services as time goes on. To avoid a shutdown in July, the 304-page bill that contained this provision was quickly put through without anyone having a chance to read it. We could only hope that this language in the bill was a dreadful mistake. To put it bluntly, if it's not stopped, this law will kill people. But it'll torture them first. For example, exactly how long can a person with kidney failure survive without dialysis? We don't want to think anyone wants to watch that and find out how long it takes. So having the wrong immigration status shouldn't be a death sentence. Political games should not result in inhumane laws like it was passed in July of 2011. I won't read a list. You have a copy of our testimony, but there's a list of services that will be denied, and this law must stop. I also believe that this law highlights that if we had a better healthcare system where every person would be covered and have access to good and affordable healthcare, we wouldn't have to be waiting to an emergency to get help. Surely we don't want to be sitting here deciding who gets medical help and what kind of services they get or not. Thank you very much.
And thank you very much. And Ms. Hardy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Shantara Hardy, and I'm the manager of government relations at Health Partners. As you know, Health Partners is an integrated healthcare system with hospitals, clinics, and a health plan operating in the Twin Cities, St. Cloud, Stillwater, Duluth, and Western Wisconsin. I'm here today just to discuss the impact of the changes to emergency medical assistance, not only to our hospital, Regents Hospital, but also to our clinic system. In 2011, our clinics provided services to a little over 150 emergency medical assistant or EMA patients. Our preliminary analysis shows that they are frequent visitors with significant medical needs. 111 have been seen in the last 6 months. 42 of them have been seen in the last 30 days. Most of them have more than three or more chronic healthcare conditions. So while we know this may be not a large number of patients in our system, their care is very challenging and expensive for the system. Regents has a long history of providing care to patients regardless of their ability to pay, doing our part to improve care, but also to coordinate care so that we are being accountable to lowering costs in the system. Yes, emergency services according to DHS will be covered. However, we're concerned about the chronically ill individuals who will eventually come to our emergency department for services such as chemotherapy and dialysis, which are outpatient services. In 2010, we faced, some may say, one of the greatest challenges in our state, which was restoring GAMC. However, I'm here to tell you that emergency medical assistance population has higher needs, they're sicker, and their care is more costly. Emergency and medical assistance is a safety net for the safety net, and we're concerned that people will not only fall through the cracks, they will continue to fall. As we begin to think about a new model of care for EMA enrollees, I urge you to continue to direct resources to emergency care, but most importantly, find resources to pay for those critical outpatient services. I am confident that we will all rise to the challenge, as we did with GAMC, to provide the best care, best experience for this population. I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, I appreciate you coming, and if Mr. Scandrett and Schmidt want to join the panel, you can be there to be available for questions. That's what I was kind of thinking. I have a couple comments, then we'll offer some testimony or member comments. We have happily 15 or 20 minutes left to chat about this, and this is not the final meeting about this topic. I was in that room at the end of session in July. I was talking to people in June. You know, this committee never quit working, and people offered advice all the way through from, I didn't select the method that it was done in. I just had to work within that method. It was all beyond my control. Not even trying to avoid my responsibilities. When we discussed this is at the very end, and the topic was about emergencies. We didn't use the word immigrant one time in a sentence in that whole dialogue. It came up as the scope creep on emergencies. And I didn't even know a lot about the program at the time, to tell you the truth. I knew it existed. I knew it was important. It helped a bunch of people. I now find out $2,500, $44 million, $17,000 a person in 2011, which is a lot of money per person. And it made sense to try to rein back the expansive use of a word that had grown to be a vague term. The program was at $44 million, 44 point something, in 2011, state and federal shared, $50 million in 2012, 55 point something million in 2013 scheduled. That's 10% a year. And I asked Ms. Dorfman, and I'll ask anybody, I'm just puzzled how emergencies could have increased at 10% a year with relative populations staying, blinking in and out, and it was no explosion in the population. So it dawned on me as I look at this. So that's the challenge that I face. And these people blink in and blink out, and I'm glad they could mail a letter to the people. I didn't ask the department how many people got the letter. I don't know that. You know, did they have a good mailing address? I mean, you know, this is a program that was just kind of in the shadows. It was there, and it's growing, and now suddenly all these questions get arised, and we think in a sensible reform to define emergency that we got this. And so the $33 million that's left scheduled for 2013 is a 25% reduction off the base of 2011, which gives me hope for optimism we can find a way to manage it better in the same way we did GAMC stuff with our healthcare homes and the Representative Murphy's worked on so much,
and we've seen success coming from, and manage these clients, not let them blink in and out of a fee-for-service model where the providers are only encouraged to deliver services without any feedback, if it helped or anything like that. So that's the hope I see in this thing. I just wanted to comment about that. And so there's a couple of matters that we have to deal with this session that are to be resolved. This is one of them. I don't think there's much more money than $33 million available to work on this area. I could be wrong. Find me some other money from some other pot. A lot of people are concerned about the school shift. And so that's going to take up some money if there's a big surplus increase. And I think that's a bipartisan concern about that. But I am, if I summarize my view of the bill that we did, I'm happy that we got the cost to the point of the overall budget, $25 billion or whatever it is this coming cycle, all funds, that it's something we actually can, we can keep the promises we've made to people. We now have to find ways to do a better job of keeping promises to people that we didn't know we had broken, if we'd broken some. And I'm willing to look at anything about that. I'm concerned about the lower needs a reduction 10% of some of the CADI people. The mental health piece has been neglected in that. We have to solve that with our in our committee. I'm concerned about the sudden bed closure piece on the TBI and CADI waivers for those corporate foster beds. But those all cost money. And so we have to find more ways to be effective. And I just commend beyond anything the three groups that appeared earlier today, the Lincoln Lyon Murray Group, the Southeastern Minnesota Group, and the White Earth Tribes, as we try to redesign our system to make it sustainable and affordable, because we all in Minnesota care about this. No one wants to see anybody die or come to harm. And that's my commitment as a chair and to the testifiers and to those who came to watch this topic and who care about the rest of this. So our work is not done, but we have at least gotten out of the fire. Now we're just in a really hot room, and it's not even that comfortable yet. So, so what I saw, so my concern is and we can, there's a, one person has a question. I think we've crept in our scope of emergency, and how do we define it more properly? And I think we've crept in our scope of people we agreed to serve to people that we did not agree to serve. How do we handle that? Some of those are very difficult to address. So those are just my thoughts. And then one thing that Ms. Hardy said, talked about frequent visitors. Well, if you have frequent visitors to your ER, that sounds like the GAMC problem and the CCDS solution and healthcare homes management and primary care and FQHCs that Mr. Scandrett represents. So anyway, those are just my thoughts on the topic. I assume responsibility for what I'm responsible for. So Representative Franson, you can be the first.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And this question is for any of you up at the testifying stand. Thank you. You know, this, we live in the greatest land, the United States of America, and I'm just wondering, you know, so many people want to come here because of the opportunity that America presents for itself. And while we can empathize with those that are not insured by being here illegally, what are you guys doing to encourage people to become citizens so that the benefits that they receive, they are earning, and then the taxpayers themselves are feeling a bit more comfortable of where their dollars are going?
Mr. Skendra.
Yeah, that is a really good question, and actually we've learned a lot in the last couple of months looking at the program, and this is similar to other programs that people have been have experience with here, where you discover that there may be more people eligible for other programs than we realized, and there actually are quite a few people that are on the road to citizenship. They're lawfully here, and so there's things we can do to help them along that road so that they would be eligible for other programs. And there's also things that we can do to identify the people that are already eligible for other programs but are in this because they don't realize they're already eligible for other programs. And so and I know the immigration issue is really important, and I would say that I would love to have the chair schedule a hearing where we can really give it the attention it deserves. I think in this case, where our main concern is, we know that this is not the session to solve immigration problem, the problems, even if this were the body that could do it. And so the immediate concern is that we would like this program to be fixed as quickly as possible in order to restore some of the services that we all know should be provided. And then we would like an opportunity and another time to talk about the broader issue of coverage for other people that even with these changes would not be eligible. So just trying to segment the issues for what we need to deal with immediately and what we need to deal with greater time and attention.
I have a response.
Yes,
to I met with the family members of one of the residents. She's a 91-year-old Hispanic lady, and the daughter looked at me, and I asked the daughter, I said, well, how long has your mother been in Minnesota? 1973. She never thought it was important to become a citizen, for whatever reason, the daughter said. She's been in this state since 1973. She's 91 years old, chronic condition, is on hospice. For whatever reason, she did not feel it was important to become a citizen. Her daughters and her kids are all citizens of this wonderful state, but she chose not to be. And I don't know why.
And just, I had the legislation copied, so you can read the text if you wanted to. Members have that. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just will be brief, but I do want to touch on the nursing home care of these residents. And you did give us an example there. I also have had experience in my nursing in the nursing home with young men and young people who get into a car motorcycle accident and become injured for life and tube-fed for life and intubated for life. And there's an extreme cost to that the nursing homes incur. And we all know that the nursing homes don't have the money. So I'm wondering where and how long, Mr. Chairman, will we discuss this while we know that we have $33 million, and I'm asking that, we could look at moving this along, not quickly, but in some regards immediately, so that those folks and those nursing homes are not going to incur a higher cost and go broke. We can't turn these people away. We can't send them back to the hospital. So I think what my nursing homes are probably doing is keeping them longer than they can afford to. So I would stress upon you and this committee that I think we ought to take a look at some legislation to fix this problem that has happened sooner than later. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. And is the department here? Could they come down and join the panel? I'm not sure who's here on their behalf today. I know that the first crew, Julie Marquardt, hiding up there. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is maybe a comment and a question if anyone wants to respond. But as I look at the handout given by the Welfare Rights Committee, thank you for this. Mr. Chair, I appreciate your ability to define the problem in terms of the fact that we had scope creep in terms of trying to define what an emergency is and what should and should not be covered. And as I look at the list here of the services to be denied, there's a few that kind of stick out that if they were included as deemed emergency, I'd be very surprised. In terms of elective surgery is one, chiropractic services. These are items that I hear from constituents a lot that have frustrations as private payers having access to these or being covered by insurance for, you know, the premiums they pay and everything else. And so I guess my question would be, is there a willingness to acknowledge that the definition of emergency maybe had gotten a bit beyond what we can control, beyond what is reasonable? I don't know if this list here is what you would endorse, that all of these should be covered, or if you would concede that maybe there was a bit of a scope creep as the chair defined, and I would just like to hear any response. Because to me that just sticks out. We have an issue with this for people who pay for their insurance, you know, work their jobs, pay premiums, and have a hard time finding access to some of these services. And so any response would be greatly appreciated.
Mr. Scandrett, or...
Well, I mean, the general response is that we just have to be careful how we describe an emergency situation. And if you have an emergency situation and these aren't, then where do these folks go? So I think part of the discussion is if we have emergencies, and then what do we do with all the other people that don't have emergencies, like having, you know, a good health care system, because I think some of the stuff is preventable or at least, you know, manageable under a good health care system. That, I mean, that's just my opinion, so.
Mr. Scandrett, do you want to?
Mr. Chair, and I think it's a really good question, and I think given what this program was intended for, at least as we're talking to many of the groups, we would agree that there are ways that we can tighten the program so that it focuses on serious medical conditions, because this isn't the program that's intended to provide those additional services. Now, well, there are many of us that will advocate for other strategies to make sure there's more comprehensive insurance provided, and that, again, is that hearing that we hope we'll have someday. But for this program, given the intent, what we just think is we need to define it a little bit differently so that we can get at these serious things that don't technically meet the definition of an emergency, but if we didn't provide them, they're serious enough that they will lead to an emergency, just not within 48 hours. And so what we'll be working on for the committee would be something that does keep it limited to the more serious medical conditions and not open it to other types of services as well.
Mr. Mack, I appreciate the question. And I think part of the answer for this group, this is another like mini GAMC group. It's even, I think, more amorphic than the GA group was. But I think if we can get them into some primary care and try to get them healthier in some more regular way, that they might not need so much emergency care, which is part of, I hope I'm right about that. So I see the department snuck up behind there. So if they could, one of them could comment about what you're doing about the nursing home situation. And does one of you, is that, I see Julie's there and Ms. Gibson. And which of you want to take the, can you just, you know, earlier, too bad Scott had to bail on you. He'd be up there otherwise. So you can thank him for that. You owe him. He owes you one. But can you kind of comment on what the department's position has been on some of these people who have been receiving a service in a nursing home for some time, and did they, just what's going to happen to them? Is that in your view? As an example.
Yeah. Is that my name is question? Julie Marquardt. I'm the Acting Director for Health Services and Medical Management at DHS. And Mr. Chair, I think the one thing that we're doing most immediately is the limited exception. Is applying that limited exception where the person's housing and their medical care are integral to keeping them basically out of the emergency room. If we removed all of that, they'd be in the emergency room immediately. But outside of that, the way that the law is written, it's clear that the nursing facility is considered chronic care. That people who are in nursing facilities are in a state of chronic condition, and so there isn't a vehicle at this time to pay for those without some change in the law.
And so currently, if they're in a nursing home having gotten the service for some period of time, that the nursing home has to either absorb the cost or turn them to HCMC, ER or something. Which then makes it an emergency. Do they get covered then, or the exception?
If a person who is residing in a nursing facility who doesn't have a limited exception did develop an emergency condition where they needed to be brought to the hospital, they would be covered for that medical emergency. But yes, you're correct that there wouldn't be.
But not for the care. Not for the care in the nursing home. So
right.
So is it a minute for these two residents that reside in our care center? We will not get any payment for their services that we're providing.
So it is a catch-22, isn't it?
That is correct.
Anyway, Representative Loeffler and Representative Murphy, and then that might be the end of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And McDonald.
And members, it seems to me that we've always been a compassionate state, but we've always been also tried in this committee, I think on a bipartisan basis, to be smart and strategic. And have done a lot of good work together to try and reduce medical costs, but we have a long ways to go. And anyone who's watching this or here knows that medical inflation has been incredibly high, as reflected in all of our insurance premiums and the stories that we hear from our constituents about that. And so to expect that the costs wouldn't go up significantly for the sickest of the sick, no matter where they came from or what their life situation is, to me is not surprising. But what is surprising to me is that we inadvertently, unknowingly, unwisely, uncounseled wise, ended up in law with a provision that right now is going to take us backwards. Because we have advanced so far in medicine that we can treat people outside of the hospital with really serious, terrible things happening to them. We can save lives that in the past we never had to pay for. They had an emergency room visit. They got the best, you know, triage they could get, and they maybe lasted a few months, and now they last years in nursing homes and with the support services that modern medicine has been able to provide. And we passed a law recently, Representative Fritz brought it forward, in which we had to pass a law to say we could take advantage of the new medicine that says you can get chemotherapy via a pill without having to be admitted into a hospital with an IV tube fastened to your arm. And now we're saying to all those people who could maybe keep working and supporting their family who've got a cancer diagnosis, to get what you need to survive, you have to give up your work and check into a hospital, and the hospital won't get paid. It'll get passed on to your property taxes. And I think we can just be much more strategic, and I think the solution for us has to include opening the doors beyond the hospital to that, those kind of smart use of community facilities, home care, nursing homes, outpatient services for these people, rather than filling up our burdened hospitals with people who go in because that's the only way to get the bill paid. And I hope we'll open the doors beyond the hospitals, because I think that's the smart and cost-effective way to go.
And I'm looking for advice. So, Representative Murphy. Oh, you don't want it. Okay. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll ask this question offline then. It has to do with the limited exception.
Okay.
And maybe perhaps Mrs. Marquette can stay after and answer that for me.
Yeah. And we have expended our time, but I think it's a productive discussion. Just one more question from Ms. Marquardt. Another reason to be angry at Scott. Okay. Has the department suggested any short-term legislation to address this nursing home piece or anything? You know, has that, they have a, they have not made a proposal as of now to do something about that, right?
We're looking at lots of options, and we're speaking with a lot of stakeholders and legislators, yeah. And so no, we have nothing proposed at this time, but we are looking at options.
And I thought you were, and so Representative Fritz, we're all ideas, and I hope that many people came just for this part, and I appreciate coming for that. It's on our minds. We're from the government. We're here to help. Isn't always not true. And so we'd like to do our best to resolve this. This is the idea crafting stage. March will be oh, by the way, deadlines have been announced. Speaking of deadlines, March 16th is the first deadline. You know, they picked my plan. They didn't even know that was my plan, but they picked my idea. So I want to thank the world for that. It's actually Friday. So March 16th, March 23rd, March 30th. So 30th will be the finance deadline, so a little bit of time. This is a very humane schedule for us to accomplish many important things. We're not meeting tomorrow. We're back on Tuesday. I want to thank everybody for their coming today, the people that traveled. Excuse me, we're back on Wednesday. Wednesday. Go to your caucuses. Sorry. Thanks, Representative Schumacher. We're adjourned. Thank you. Wednesday.